The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Bain publisher Toni Weisskopf and her happy puppers bring you Bain's summer release schedule, talking about all the fresh hotness to come. Then, we bring you more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 61.
Summertime. I hope everybody's starting to get ready for summertime. We have a great lineup of Bain books for you. All right. We're going to kick things off in May with Penryk's Intrigues by Lois McMaster-Bujold. Lois is one of my favorite authors. I don't think that comes as a surprise to anybody. Penryk is one of my favorite characters of Lois. He is a lot of fun, and his marriage is a lot of fun. They have to do a lot to accommodate each other. So at any rate, Penryk is exploring his world. These are fantasy adventures. They are lovely. They are great fun, and I highly recommend them. Let's see. Also in May, we have a collection of Liaden Universe stories by Sharon Lee and Steve Miller. They too are absolutely great fun in a completely different way. They are space opera stories, space adventure stories, all kinds of stories that you can tell in the great, huge, wide universe that is the Liaden Universe. And that is Liaden Constellation Volume 6, coming out in May. We also have the trade paperback edition of Steve Sterling's Alternate History. This volume is titled The Winds of Fate. And in this alternate history, it's really time travel slash alternate history, we have Americans who are sent back just ahead of nuclear apocalypse, back to the time of Marcus Aurelius, and they are trying to survive in this world with plagues and war and persecution, if they can, leave the world a better place. So that is The Winds of Fate, out in trade paperback in May. And our mass markets are Not That Kind of Good Guy by John Ringo and Toll of Honor by David Weber. Toll of Honor is going to be in June. We'll give you a little preview there. So Not That Kind of Good Guy by John Ringo. Again, a very different kind of book from all the other books in May. This one is a superhero conspiracy theory novel. It's the first one in this series where you're introduced to a trademark John Ringo smartass. He is just coming into his superpowers, never asked for them, doesn't want them, and is not at all quiet about telling everybody in the universe about his problems. In the meantime, he also is solving other people's problems and uncovering a truly horrific background to this. I would call this fantasy, but all the conspiracies that John is talking about are coming real in real life. So read Not That Kind of Good Guy. Up in June, we have yet another completely different kind of book, historical urban fantasy road trip adventure by DJ Butler and David West. That's right, two Davids for the price of one. Two Davids for the price of one, called Hell on Wheels. It is, if you like hot cars and hot chicks and really cool magical systems, you are going to enjoy this adventure going across the United States in a car with spirits on your tail. Hell on Wheels. That's coming in June. And we have a lovely hard science fiction adventure by James Cambius called The Ishtar Deception. The Ishtar Deception takes place in a far, far future where humanity has spread out through the solar system. We've got incredibly intelligent AIs. We have an incredible amount of energy and just a wide range of beings defining what it is to be human, what it is to be sentient. And in the middle of this, we have a smart aleck AI named Dazlak and a very chill, cool, laid-back James Bond kind of dude. And they are having adventures on Ishtar. I am very, very picky about what I like to publish called AI, right? Camus really understands. He really gets it, and he really makes it clear on the page. All while just telling a beautiful adventure and a great travelogue across the solar system about all the amazing things you're going to see. One of my favorite genres, hard science fiction there. In trade paperback, I believe for the first time, is 1632 by Eric Flint. Sort of the granddaddy of all time travel slash alternate history novels that has now, of course, turned into a multi-million dollar and multi-million word shared universe adventure, 1632 in trade paperback. And again, in mass market, we have Toll of Honor, which is David Weber's latest Honorverse adventure, where we're going back in time and getting a different viewpoint on a key part of Manticoran history. Coming up in July, all right, I have to say, A Call to Deception is scheduled for July, due to the real world happening, that is going to be postponed. We don't have the pre-order up yet, and we believe it will be postponed for a few months. But it will be a new Travis Long adventure, and if you watch our socials and our webpage, we will let you know when that book will become available for pre-order. But also in July, we have Thieves' Guy by Will McCarthy. Again, this is hard science fiction, but unlike the Cambius novel, this is far closer to our timeline. We have a future where billionaires are responsible for our expansion out into space, and we have an encounter with probably an alien technology, hard to say. It's certainly something that we've never seen before. And in Thieves' Guy, this this piece of maybe alien technology gets stolen. We have a race to make sure that we don't accidentally blow up our own sun. So that's Thieves' Guy. Tempered by Fire is our trade paperback in July. Tempered by Fire is, again, completely different genre from the ones we've been talking about before. It is a post-apocalypse military fantasy with dragons and griffins. So fans of Anne McCaffrey, you're going to love this. Fans of Bane stuff, you're going to love this. It's Melissa is doing... With this world, she is doing really, really fun things, and I think you guys are going to like it. Also in July, we have The Mass Market of Fenrir by Eric Flint and Reich Spohr. Fenrir, despite its elusive title to Norse mythology, is actually hard science fiction. And it deals with a object coming from interstellar space, coming through our solar system, and acting not like any other object that we've seen before. In fact, what it starts acting like is a spaceship. Now, as it happens, I'm talking now in early April of 2026, we have an object coming in from interstellar space that's not acting precisely like a comet, and it might be acting like a spaceship. So this is one of several novels that Bane has published where this is the signal, and then the adventure starts from there. So Eric Flint and Reich Spohr investigating this entirely all too probable phenomena. And finally, wrapping up the season is Behind the Veil, The Mass Market of Behind the Veil by John Ringo and Lydia Scherer. This is book four? Yes? Yes. This is book four of the, is Behind the Veil of the fourth one or the third one? No, it is the third one. It's book three. It's book three of their series that started with Into the Real, which is an alien invasion story, but in an alien invasion story like none you've ever seen before. The aliens are electrovores, and it's a very, very subtle alien invasion until it's not. And book three cranks up the heat on this, and book four, which is out, we have a completed series wraps it up in just absolutely beautiful, beautiful style. I will point out that many of these books are eligible for Dragon Awards, and we encourage everybody who reads to go and nominate and then vote on the Dragon Awards. If you guys have your favorites, you know, let people know. Dragon Awards is one way to do that. So,
I was trying to remember there.
All right. Then we have in August, again, a completely different subgenre. We touched on the first book in this series, 1632, by Eric Flint. And we have a brand new book in the Ring of Fire series, is 1637, Pilgrim's Passage, by Eric Flint and Griffin Barber. This is the third book in the series that Griffin kicked off with, what was the title?
Mission to the Mughals.
Mission to the Mughals, and then there was the Peacock Throne. So this is the next one in the series, and the pilgrimage is from India on the way to Mecca, it is an interesting interesting travel, not without its speed bumps. There is a lovely birthing scene in this one that is right up there with the birthing scene in Cordelia's Honor, so in Barrayar as well. So I highly recommend this one. Also in hardcover in August, we have a new to Bane author, Shami Stovall. She was one of the finalists of the Bane Fantasy Adventure Award a few years ago, and this is her first novel with us. She's been publishing indie novels for a while now and doing great things. The novel is called One Fifth Dragon. We've got an absolutely gorgeous Todd Lockwood cover for this lovely, lovely Japanese inspired dragon. The novel is also in a Japanese-inspired fantasy world, but it is not Japan. And it is about a young man who is coming into his birthright. I will say no more about that, but it is a great adventure, and we are happy to have Shami Stovall part of the Bane family. So that's hardcovers for August. Our trade paperback in August is The Sands of Mars by Rob Hampson, known to some of you barflies as Speaker to Lab Animals. Why is he called Speaker to Lab Animals? Well, because he's a research neuroscientist, not anything more strange than that. That's plenty strange enough. Sands of Mars is part of his hard science fiction series, and what is it the sequel to?
The Moon, or...
Yes, The Moon in the Desert. The Moon in the Desert, yes. Where we have our main character who survived all of the travails of the moon and the desert, has become a modern bionic man, and now he gets his life's wish, his dream come true. He gets to go be part of the first colony on Mars. Be careful what you wish for. this is part of the lovely conversation all about what it will take for humans to become a two-planet civilization. And there's some answers to questions that were raised in Andy Weir's books, and there's a lot of hard science fiction thinking going into this, as well as great adventures. So, Sands of Mars, out in August, and rounding out the season, we have Behind the Veil by John Ringo and Lydia Scherer. This is book three in their series that started with Into the Real, and it is an alien invasion story, a near future alien invasion story like none you have ever seen before. The aliens are electrovores, and it's a very subtle alien invasion until it's not. And in book three, it's starting to become really not. We have a great cast of characters that we're getting to see, very, very Harry Potter style, grow up, and grow up in a time of war. So Behind the Veil in mass market out in August. I think we've got some fun beach reads here. We've got some good things coming up. We look forward to hearing your feedback on this stuff. So, good reading, guys.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
Chapter 22. I came awake slowly. My eyes opened before they could focus, and they focused before I could process what I was seeing. It wasn't much. A smooth, white expanse, the whiteness blurry at the edges. I tried to roll over, but I couldn't move my body. I lifted my head and looked down my chest. I was lying on some sort of table, naked but not cold. The surface below me, warm, and my body wrapped securely in restraining plastic. An IV hung from each of my arms, the attached tubes running beside my body and behind my head to destinations I couldn't see. I felt nice, warm, and secure. No worries, no troubles. I closed my eyes briefly and enjoyed the warmth, then opened them as I realized I missed the pretty whiteness, so soft and pure and far away. I smiled at it. I thought I saw it move, and when I squinted, I was sure it was smiling back at me. I realized it was a ceiling. It was a great ceiling, and I was happy to be there with it. A pressure grew in the back of my head and distracted me from the whiteness. I didn't like the pressure, but it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't leave me alone. And then it burst into a thought, a realization that filled me. This was all wrong. I was drugged, and I needed to get away. Nanomachines. I needed to release some nanomachines to remove my bindings. I waded into the dense cloud of my brain, trying to concentrate, and then I heard a soft chime, a tiny, faraway sound, and I was out. I was asleep, and then I wasn't. The line between sleep and waking unclear and shifting, my eyes shut, then open, then shut again. I felt a smile, then realized happily that it was mine. My eyes cleared enough that I could see whiteness above me, and I remembered it was my ceiling. I smiled more broadly, glad to see it again. Right after the memory of the ceiling came the recollection of the lovely warm bed, the happy-hugging plastic, and the tubes in my arms. I knew where I was. I was where I'd been before. I was glad I'd figured that out. I wondered why I'd left. There was certainly no reason to leave such a comfy place. I must have been acting silly. Yeah, that was it. Silly. I remembered something else silly, a tiny little chime, one I could hear but not see. I was happy to remember it. As I lay there thinking, I realized I was happy about everything, though everything wasn't very much. The ceiling, the chime, the bed, the plastic, the IVs, and me, all together, all part of each other, all happy. Except the chime wasn't there, and that bothered me. Bothered me enough that I stopped smiling. Where was the chime? The question bounced around in my mind, a fuzzy ball ricocheting off the walls of the empty room of my brain, gaining speed until I realized I only heard the chime before I went to sleep. More knowledge followed that realization, a rapid-fire tumble of blurry recollection. I went to sleep after I heard the chime, after I tried to concentrate, after I figured out this was wrong. This was wrong. I remembered that I needed to focus, so I could instruct the nanomachines to decompose the plastic and free me. Focusing was difficult, but I tried. I thought hard for what might have been a split second or an hour. I couldn't tell. Then I heard the chime again and just had time to figure out that I didn't want to go to sleep before I was out. I realized I was awake when I noticed that instead of dancing swirls of yellows and red, I was now seeing white, the white of the ceiling, the lovely ceiling. Memories accompanied the vision of the ceiling, the warm bed, the warm plastic, the IV tubes in me, the bad chime. I remembered now. When the chime played, the ceiling vanished, or did I vanish? One of us definitely went away. I was sure of that. I lay still for a bit, enjoying the ceiling, happy in the realization I'd achieved, until a question shoved the happiness away. What made the chime play? The chime. I repeated the word in my head, enjoying how it felt. Chime, 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 chime. The knowledge crept into my mind so slowly I couldn't be sure when it first appeared. I made the chime play. Why would I do that? I made the chime play, which made the ceiling go away, but I liked the ceiling. It was a puzzle, and puzzles are fun, but the pieces of this one weren't fitting right. Like me, I realized, like the way I didn't fit here, not in the bed, not under the plastic, not here at all, I should leave. The tumble of memory, or was it imagination, rolled over me. To leave, I needed the nanomachines, and to get them, I needed to focus, to think hard, and when I tried to do that, the chime rang. More memory or more imagination? I'd done this before. I needed to know if I was remembering or imagining, but that could cost me. Still, I had to know. I started a little song in my head, a gentle tune, two words repeating over and over. Concentration costs, concentration costs. I tried to keep it going, make it something I couldn't forget. And when I focused on the nanomachines, focused as directly as I could manage, the ceiling vanished. I woke with a song playing in my head, two words repeating, concentration costs. Memories flowed like water into the bowl of my mind, filling me. Bed, warm, ceiling, plastic, tubes, chime, concentration costs. Concentration brings chime, brings sleep. I wanted to stay awake, so I stayed loose, kept my eyes open, enjoyed the ceiling, and let time ease by. Not focusing or concentrating, but not sleeping either. I kept my eyes open and let my thoughts dance in slow motion through my mind as I waited to see what was next. My awareness slowly increased. I noticed the slight pressure of the plastic covering, the contrasts of temperature between my cool, uncovered face and my warm, plastic-wrapped body. Each time a thought tempted me to pay it more attention, I turned my attention away from it. Concentration costs.
Very good,
a voice said from all around me. Another temptation. This voice was another test. So I let the words wash through me, but didn't allow them to send waves across the mental pond on which I was floating.
We were wondering, the voice said, how long it would take you to figure out that you had to stay completely relaxed. I'm sure you'll be pleased to know you beat our expectations.
It wasn't a nice voice. It was nowhere near as nice as the ceiling, and that surprised me. Slowly, new knowledge crept over me. The voice was harsh because it was the product of a cheap synthesizer, and it was all around me, courtesy of speakers. I smiled and felt happy at the way my subconscious was injecting bits of information into me without requiring me to concentrate. Good subconscious. I wished I could pet it to thank it.
I'm going to raise the brainwave tolerance level slightly, the voice said, but don't take this as an invitation to do anything. With the IVs, we can knock you out in less than a second, and if that fails, we can jettison the room you're in. You're in a low orbit, and we'd aim you into the atmosphere so you wouldn't last long. I fought to relax, but an image of burning smacked into my brain, and I suddenly realized I had to get out, to escape. The chime sounded. At this level, the voice said, you get one warning tone. Let your brain activity rise much further, and we'll take you down again. The voice paused. I used the quiet to calm myself further, shutting my eyes and grabbing at the edges of sleep without giving into it completely. You showed us once that you know how to relax, the voice said. Show us again. I bathed in the colors on the inside of my eyelids, letting them wash over me and soothe me, then slowly opened my eyes and enjoyed the ceiling. Time passed, maybe another few seconds, maybe an hour, I couldn't tell, and I couldn't let it matter. Well done, the voice said. Now we can begin. I closed my eyes again, mentally crawling as far towards sleep as I could while remaining able to hear, knowing I needed to listen, but not to concentrate on what I heard. The words, a gentle shower I had to let rain on me. On Flordin, the voice continued, you evaded security, stole a weapons control system, and escaped while the man in charge went missing. Flordin. The name rolled across the floor of my mind, accumulating debris as it went. Trent Johns, vanishing. Osterlad, setting me up. Lobo, whole again. On Mackin. You rescued a girl, and you did it as best we can tell without any real help. Jasmine's face materialized in my mind. Mouth open in fear as I took her on the cart to her kidnapper, to Slake. Slake, who was the man behind all my troubles, who was also, I suddenly realized, almost certainly the one who'd arranged my kidnapping. The two images assaulted me. Jasmine and Slake, pain at what I'd done and anger at being used, the two of them combining to generate more emotion and mental temptation than I could manage while remaining this calm. The chime sounded its sole warning. Relax, Mr. Moore, the voice said. We simply want to know how you did these things. Something is unusual here, and we want to know what. Paranoia joined the pain and the anger as I realized that if I lost control and talked, then they'd know the truth about me and never let me go. I'd end up a corporate research guinea pig because they'd know that nanomachine/human integration was not only possible, but alive and well. I couldn't let that happen. I couldn't tolerate it. I had to get away. I had to. Another chime sounded. Awareness crawled over me like a foggy dawn, my mind waking up but remaining soft, fuzzy, and unfocused. Memories slowly took form as where I was, what was happening, and what I had to do to stay awake congealed in the ooze that was my brain. I remember the voice that surrounded me, but I couldn't recall whether I'd heard it once or many times, nor was I sure how many times I'd passed out from whatever drugs they were using on me. I knew I had to stay awake to have any chance of escape, so I tried to remain relaxed. Perhaps more memories would return. A door snicked open somewhere behind me. I heard the soft footsteps of someone entering the room and walking toward me. The person stopped far enough away that I couldn't see who it was. Mr. Moore, a male voice said, because you've been unwilling to answer our questions thus far, my employer has decided to pursue a more aggressive option. Up to now,
We've merely kept you sedated and used some drugs to knock you out each time you showed any sign of significant mental activity. I'm here to apply some additional incentives. I felt the man's hands working on my head and neck, jabbing me slightly and sticking cold things to me. I kept my breathing light and avoided concentrating on anything in particular. The voice I'd heard before flooded the room.
Mr. Moore. John, it said, the synthesized speech harsh and unpleasant. I encourage you to answer our questions, spare yourself pain, and save us all time. How did you manage the theft on Florden, and where's the man who was in charge there? How did you rescue the girl on Mackin all by yourself? And I must now add one more question. What has Jose Chung said to you?
Images of the people washed across my mind. John's, his head dissolving, Jasmine, her face drugged and afraid, and Chung on the med bed, anguished over Jasmine. I worked on my breathing and gently pushed them away. Not wanting to focus so much, I ended up asleep again. I alternated gazing at the ceiling with studying the colors inside my eyes, and time passed. I have no clue how much.
Your choice, the voice said.
I heard the man behind me step away, and for a few moments I thought they might wait for me to make another mistake, cause the chime to sound, and be drugged into sleep again. Pain smashed into my head. A jagged, lancing sensation ripped through my neck and into my mind. I screamed, a long, loud roar that hurt my throat, and even as I was screaming, the pain increased. For a split second, I wondered how they could hurt me without putting me back into sleep, but the pain shoved aside all thought and filled me, cut me, crushed me, my head and neck and shoulders flexing and tensing uncontrollably, my body spasming, my bowels emptying. I grabbed at the possibility that the pain would bring me focus and let me control my nanomachines, but as fast as the thought came, it flew away. I couldn't think, couldn't do anything other than hurt, hurt, hurt. Still, the pain slammed into me, growing and filling me and pushing at my edges until I was sure I would explode. A higher screeching scream erupted from me as if it were an animal fleeing a fire. The pain increased until it obscured all thought, and I was sure I was dying, and then black unconsciousness overtook me. I didn't want to wake up, though I couldn't remember why, so I fought to stay asleep, resisting awakening by clinging to wispy dream images that became more and more faint even as I struggled to maintain my grip on them. Despite my attempts, however, my mind came more and more aware until I remembered with the fuzziness of a dying display where I was, what my captors were seeking, and the pain. The memory of the pain triggered an involuntary flinch as I sought to run away, even though at some level I knew I was restrained. No pain hit me now, however. So I quit resisting consciousness and opened my eyes. My body ached a bit, as if I'd been exercising strenuously for a long day, and my neck and head were tender, but I otherwise felt more normal than I would have believed possible under the onslaught of the torture. My skin was dry, and my groin and rear felt dry against the plastic and the bed. After a few moments, my fuzzy brain realized someone must have cleaned me. I was grateful for that courtesy, and I clung to the positive feeling of gratitude like a drowning man clutching a float.
Welcome back, John, the voice said. I really don't understand what could be important enough for you to endure this ordeal. We've studied what little data we can find on you, and nothing appears extraordinary. Your records begin less than 40 years ago. You've worked for the SAW and a few other mercenary groups before it. You've acted as a rather expensive but apparently successful private courier. And that's about all we know. Explain the girl's rescue and the episode on Florden. Tell us what Chung had to say and we'll stop all this.
I wasn't sure how much I could take. I'd sometimes imagined that I'd be able to resist interrogation by finding a mental safe house, a place to retreat within my mind. But in my heart, I knew that I, like all other people, would break eventually. I had to get out before I did. Once they discovered the truth about me, I'd never be free again. My mind seemed sharper than before, so I tried to focus enough to communicate with the nanomachines. A chime sounded. Before the noise could fade, the pain stabbed again into my head and neck, filling my vision with a black-red darkness. One intense jolt, and then the pain stopped, but it was enough to make the point. I did my best to relax, to think of nothing, to exist, but do no more.
"John," the voice said, "I hope you understand that I'm not enjoying this. None of us wanted it to come to this. Answer the questions and we'll be done."
For a moment, that seemed the most reasonable solution in the world. The residual shock waves of the pain in my body leaving me longing to make the voice happy. I opened my mouth to speak, ready to do whatever the voice wanted. Then the reality of what would happen flooded back into me, and I understood that the time might come when I'd talk without even realizing I had. That knowledge was inexplicably the funniest thing I'd ever thought. I started laughing, lightly at first, and then wholeheartedly, my body twitching with laughter under the plastic. I laughed and laughed, unable to stop. Unable to remember why I was laughing, and weaving among the laughter was a wispy thread. I was going crazy. Maybe crazy was the safe place you went so you wouldn't talk.
"John," the voice said, "as you must know from your experience in the SAW, the issue isn't whether you'll answer, it's when you'll answer. I regret your choice."
The pain arced through me, cutting off the laughter as the muscles in my neck tensed so tightly my screams emerged as tight, compressed squeaks. More intense this time, so sharp I couldn't imagine anything else existed. The pain hit me and hit me and hit me until I could take no more and passed out. We continued in this manner. The voice and the pain and I, though I don't know for how many times and or for how long. I screamed sometimes, laughed others, and often cried, but the episodes blurred until each one began as if the first. A birth into pain, a new short life with no significant data from any prior ones, just awakening and then pain. After a time, I cringed as I awoke, enough memory lingering that I knew bad things were coming, even though I couldn't remember what any of those bad things were. I woke up and hid behind my eyelids, kept them closed, as if by not seeing the world I could deny its existence, and tried to dig my way back into sleep. I failed, but as I lay there trying to sleep, I eventually recalled the chime. That recollection led me to remember they had to be monitoring me, which in turn meant they had to know I was awake. I couldn't deceive them, I realized, and the thought filled me with despair. How could answering their questions, I wondered, make my life any worse than this? Even as I formed the question, I realized that its existence marked a major step on the path to giving up. I heard footsteps again behind me and opened my eyes, hoping for some sort of reprieve, knowing the hope was futile, but harboring it anyway. The drugs I'm adding now, the voice said from behind my head, represent the next stage. I swallowed several times until I thought I could speak. As I breathed deeply and slowly, staying unfocused and below the chime's threshold, I managed to croak out, how long? The voice laughed, a sound filled with surprise and amusement and a hint of pity, but no real humor at all. How long for the drugs to take effect? Or how long have you been here? Blackness crawled around the edges of my vision, and I couldn't tell anymore if my eyes were open or closed. Answering was beyond me. None of that will matter, he said, as the blackness completely filled my sight and crawled up my optic nerves toward my brain. Where you take yourself next?
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as we bring you science fiction grandmaster Lois McMaster Bujold, interviewed for her collection, Penric's Intrigues, and more, One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 62. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.